Good morning, everybody. We're going to go ahead and get started here. Before we get into the official program that you picked up outside, we have a special guest speaker who needs to get back up to the House. We're very pleased to welcome a good friend of the Blue-Green Alliance. He's always interested in what we're doing, and you can tell that by him making the time just to come over here and hear about this piece of our program. He's from upstate New York, where we just recently ran a pilot program as a piece of this program in Schenectady. So I'm pleased to welcome Representative Paul Tonko.
Thank you, Lauren. Good morning, everyone. It's an honor to join with Kim as your president and the foundation to address the environmental concerns that face our nation and our world and how to translate that into job creation, a growth in our economy, and an outcome that is vastly improved with our stewardship of our environment, our shared environment. I serve as ranker, which means I'm the top Democrat on the subcommittee of environment that reports to the Standing Committee of Energy and Commerce. And through the last couple of years, we've had interesting get-togethers where we were able to move forward with some progress with TSCA, albeit because of preemption concerns. I voted against my own package that I worked on, but I think we made it vastly improved from the 1976 law that it was. And everyone from the environmental community to the other end of the spectrum, the chemical industry, acknowledge it had not been working the way it was intended. And so hopefully we'll continue to monitor that progress that was achieved and make certain that we go forward with the watchdog status to make certain that the rules and regs that are promulgated on behalf of the TSCA reforms are indeed in play. As I watched and listened to the discussions of late, very, very concerned about this administration and its impact on not only the moment, but the future, not only the impact on our nation, but on the world. I was so proud of the previous administration bringing the world together at a common table and having them discuss what is the issue of our time, climate change, and that whole concept where 97% of the scientist community suggests that there is this dynamic of global warming, climate change, and that it is human-inspired. So we have it as a challenge to us, as a responsibility to generations that will follow and for our own current present moment to respond to that phenomenon in a powerful way through legislation and resources, to pull out of that accord as nations in the world over 100 have ratified that agreement, is the wrong move. Definitely wrong. You may call that a win, Mr. President, but it's wrong. And I think that we will pay the price for that. First, it's a deep scar in our image across the world. I think people acknowledge now that the force that brought us to the table is that same force that first left that table, which is, I think, a difficult calculus to somehow work through. I think that this notion of growing jobs versus cleaning up the environment are diametrically opposed is a foolish bit of conclusion. There are statistical evidences that as you serve as a strong steward of the environment, as you make us deeply, deeply green and deeply, deeply blue, jobs grow. The innovation economy is providing sound-paying jobs. I was just talking with our friends from the trades. We're talking about finding sound-paying jobs. And now when you threaten 20% cuts of staffing at EPA and 30 to 39% cuts at EPA in general, it scares me what that means to the outcome in our home states. I'm from the state of New York. We're usually above whatever federal standards we lie. So I think it's important for us to be vigilant in our attempt to understand that as we green up, we strengthen up the economy. And, you know, the efforts I'm making also are with our water infrastructure. Our drinking water systems are in failure. We still have wooden pipes, brick systems, 145-year-old infrastructure in my district, discontinued inventory, a human infrastructure that has not been fed well, no one to whom to pass the institutional knowledge as people are leaving that arena. So we've got our work to do. With infrastructure, it can't be just roads and bridges. There needs to be broadband. It needs to be the grid to upscale it so that we can accept the greening up of power supplies generated through environmental causes, through nature, our wind, our solar, our hydro systems. In order to utilize that full capacity, we need to upgrade the grid. And we need to upgrade our drinking water systems and our sewer water systems. So the environmental language, the tasks out there, the challenges, the inspirations are great. And it's a blue-green alliance, a foundation like this that acknowledges that we can grow the economy, that we need to be better stewards of the environment, and that we have to commit in policy format and resources to that cause. I want to work with you to do that. So thank you so much for bringing people together. We can do this with our friends from labor. We can do it with our friends from the environment. And we can do it from the smart thinkers on the economy. Thank you so much. Have a great conference.
You know, I do want to say privately, Congressman Tonko shared with me he was so excited about coming to this event this morning that he actually showed up to the event last week around this time. So to be here with all of you. So I really appreciate his dedication to these issues. I want to take a moment. I'm Kim Glass. I'm the executive director of the Blue-Green Alliance, and I just want to welcome all of you for making time on this very hot day in Washington, D.C., when Congress is in session and a lot of threats and opportunities confront all of us, for making the time to share half a day with us. So there's a lot of different folks in this room today, and there's a lot of advocates and experts on these issues related to toxic chemicals. There are people in this room who represent labor unions, environmental groups, wildlife organizations, and various community constituencies. That voice wants to be heard and continue to be heard despite some of the threats that we are facing, both in terms of budgetary cuts to EPA, regulatory rollbacks, and a whole host of issues happening at the community and the local level. We believe now is the time to convene this critical conversation, to bring us all together in a room, to renew our spirit of working together, but also acknowledge the fact that there's been so much work done and so much renewed work and spirit moving forward. So I just want to commend those who have been working in this space for far longer than I or the Blue-Green Alliance have over the years. And just to give you a history of the Blue-Green Alliance is a collaboration between some of the largest labor unions and some of the largest environmental organizations, spanning from industrial workers to those in the building and construction trades, to teachers, to service employees, to those in hospitals, as well as some of the largest and oldest environmental organizations across the country. And one of the founding tenets of the Blue-Green Alliance was around worker safety and health. Often workers are confronted with toxic chemicals on the job, exposure to asbestos or silica or PCBs that have threatened their livelihoods, their family, their health, and has taken a significant toll on our environment. So this has been one of our founding principles as an organization, and we want to continue not only working with you but strengthening our partnerships with you moving forward. I would say that we think the challenges, I think all of us would say this, are great at this time. We have an administration that has proposed draconian cuts to various federal agencies, including the EPA, Department of Labor, Department of Energy, and you're going to hear about some of these cuts from some union representatives who represent some of these workers and what is happening in some of these agencies and what some of the challenges are to these agencies carrying forward their missions if these draconian cuts continue through the appropriations process. But that being said, there is a spirit in the communities and in the states and even at the federal level of a lot of advocates in this room to continue doing some of the great work that we're doing, and how to do that better moving forward, and what is the leadership that we need in this, in these perilous times. So I do want to acknowledge the breadth of turnout today, people representing a broad range of organizations, but I also want to acknowledge there's several BGA, there's a BGA board member here, as well as some of our steering committee members and various partner organizations, so I just want to take a moment to acknowledge them. I would have Jim Bolin, the president of the Bricklayers, just raise his hand. He is here from the Bricklayers and Allied Craft Workers for his leadership. And I also, from our steering committee, we also have Anna Fenley from the Steelworkers, and we also will be joined by representatives from Sheet Metal, as well as the Sierra Club, as well as Natural Resources Defense Council, Environmental Defense Fund, Union of Concerned Scientists, and Communication Workers of America. Sorry, I have to, I just want to acknowledge that they've been strong supporters of this work. And we also welcome attendees from the Building Clean Partnership, including WE Act, Green and Healthy Homes Initiative, and National Housing Trust. And we have various leaders from different agencies across the administration, as well as House and Senate offices. You will hear from the stage today, our country's leadership does not solely rest on one administration or the Congress. There's a lot of work we can do together to move forward the agenda with allies like Representative Tonko, who's continuing to lead the fight in the House. It is our citizens who have led this way forward, whether we're talking about scientists or manufacturers or workers or teachers or environmentalists, labor leaders, students, who are fighting for a better world for their children and their grandchildren. And I hope you leave here today with a deeper understanding of our perils and our promises in this area, and that we will be inspired to stay strong and to take action and work together. At least for the very near future, the only protection we may have is ourselves. And thank you for, and I hope you enjoyed this symposium today. And I'm going to welcome Lauren Asplund to come to the podium to give some public service announcements about today before we formally start the program. Thank you.
Okay, just a couple of housekeeping things here. As Kim mentioned, my name is Lauren Asplund. I am the Director of Healthy Sustainability Programs. As part of that, my primary duty is doing the Building Clean Project, which is a co-sponsor of this event. You received a leaflet that explained Building Clean, and I urge you to read it and check out the website as well. The piece that really impacts here is that we do a lot of education on hazardous materials in the built environment. You also were offered at registration a ticket to the museum. If you didn't get that or you wanted extras, you should check after the first segment. The tickets are good through the end of the year, so you know, check that out if you haven't. If you haven't seen this museum, it's really incredible. While this is some really gorgeous event space, the museum itself is looking at, you know, the history of freedom of expression and First Amendment rights, and that's certainly needed in this age. We also were playing some videos while you were eating breakfast, and this is a new approach that's been developed by the Green Science Policy Institute, looking at six classes of chemicals and saying these are the worst, these are the ones we need to get rid of, and, you know, if we get rid of them, just don't, you know, make sure we're not substituting something that's also within those classes. They just came out within the last month. There's a postcard up front as well if you would like to get some more information and access to those videos, which are really good. If you didn't have a chance to see them, they're relatively short, so they're great teaching tools. We're not going to take a scheduled break today. If you need to take a call, please go out on the terrace or out to the registration area. There's no smoking in the museum, so you need to go downstairs and exit the building. The restrooms are past the registration area, on the right for the ladies' room and on the left for the men's room. Breakfast will still be out there for until 9:30, and coffee, water, and soft drinks will be available during the entire program. Finally, as we do each segment, because the first two have multiple speakers, we're going to ask you to hold your questions to the end. And then we will take questions for the speakers then. We're going to have some mic runners, not that we can't hear as well, but this is being audio recorded, so we want to make sure that we capture the question for future reference. So with that being said, what I'd like to do is to start calling up the first panel. Our first speaker is George Wyeth. His career began with the EPA began 9 years ago in the Office of General Counsel. He served 13 years as director, first of the agency's Policy and Program Change Division, and then its Integrated Environmental Strategies Division. He also spent several years on the Enforcement Program Next Generation Compliance Initiative. Now retired from the agency, Wyeth is a visiting scholar at George Washington University Law School. He's co-founded the Environmental Protection Network in the face of the unprecedented attack on the EPA. Let's welcome him to tell you more about the network and provide an analysis on recent budget events. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Lauren told me that she put together a little bio based on what she found on LinkedIn. And, you know, you have that, wow, like, what does it look like on LinkedIn? I've never, you know, actually. But that was pretty close. That was pretty accurate. Okay. I, as you said, I was at EPA for 27 years in various capacities. I'm a lawyer, but EPA is the kind of place you get to dabble in lots of things. And I left the agency at the end of January. This was something that had been planned for quite a while. It was not... not because of the election, and I thought I was going to go off to a quiet academic life, but other things are afoot these days. And it just happened that at the time that I left, a group of former EPA people were coming together to defend the agency at a time when it's not in a good position to defend itself. And so that's the organization that we're putting together called the Environmental Protection Network. We're a nonpartisan group, primarily former career, some former political appointees, primarily EPA, although we have a few state, DOJ, other agency people. We don't think of ourselves, we're not going to try to be just another green group. There are a lot of people out there advocating on all of the key issues. I think what we see ourselves as having is a large body of people. We have something like 100 people on our list, but many more other many other people out there who have been at EPA at one time or another. A deep bench of people with substantive knowledge and institutional knowledge of EPA's programs who can articulate at a pretty granular level what is going on, what the consequences of a particular decision are, the consequences of a particular budget cut might be, and it's that focus on EPA's institutional and institutional capacity and integrity, I think, is really where we're focusing. We will get engaged on certain specific policy issues, but again, we're not trying to replicate what there are lots of other groups out there working on those issues. So we're kind of looking at the core in institutional issues, and to some extent above the fray, we're providing. You're probably not going to see us buying ads in the newspaper. We're feeding information. We provide information to journalists. Journalists often want an expert to talk to about a particular program. We can help them find that. We work with Hill staff who want information about the consequences of budget cuts. We filed comments on the recent agency Federal Register notice that asked for what rules to repeal, and you've probably seen this. They asked, put out a notice saying what rules to repeal, and they got like 90% of the comments said don't repeal the rules. This is an example. Our comments didn't focus so much on specific rules, but we talked about the incredibly rigorous process that EPA rules go through. First, within the agency, there's economic analysis, there's regulatory analysis, all kinds of analysis has to be done. There's OMB that plays its role. And our point on that was the agency has a highly sophisticated system for issuing rules in the first place. There should not be some kind of presumption that there are just dozens of rules out there that were just thrown together willy-nilly. These things have a sound basis. And before you even dive into this, you need to understand the institutional underpinnings of how those rules got to be where they are. So that was where we saw ourselves contributing. When I got involved, so I'm a lawyer, and I've never worked on budget in my life. I've always kind of avoided those issues. But as I got involved with the network, I wanted to work on the budget issues because I thought that this was one of the areas where the greatest harm can be done in the shortest period of time. It doesn't require going through a rulemaking process. It doesn't. There's no judicial review. You know, Congress can just do what they want. And in the past, budget issues have not gotten a lot of attention, and so I was a little concerned that it would be under the radar. Well, that has not been the case. It's been very visible what's been going on in the budget. But I and a few others are working to do what we can to defend the agency in the budget setting. And I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this, but to give you a just sort of big picture sense of where this is, where we are in the process right now, because it is literally happening. I spent way too much time yesterday watching an endless House Appropriations markup hearing. You know, on the one hand, they're making life and death decisions, and on the other hand, it's like the most tedious thing in the world. Someone here, I'm sure, is a congressional relations person. You know exactly what I'm talking about. But just to frame this very broadly, the Trump administration put forward a proposal in March, proposed budget for EPA, that cut the overall EPA budget by 31%. That was the biggest cut to any large agency. State Department, pretty bad too, like 27%. But EPA got the largest cut of any agency. And it's clear, this is not based on policy differences. This is not a fiscal document. This is not based on analysis of priorities and needs. This was a purely ideological statement. We put out a detailed document. In the information I think you have can tell you where to find that. I guess I'm pleased to say that even in the current Congress, that proposal did not get traction. It's currently in the House Appropriations Committee. The Appropriations Subcommittee that acts on EPA's budget reported out a bill a week ago, that took the cut from 31% to 7%, and that was essentially ratified yesterday in the full House Appropriations Committee. Now, what I want to guard against is a big sigh of relief. 31, this is classic negotiation, right? You ask the outrageous, and then someone comes back with a 7% cut, and okay, good. 7%, a 7% cut to EPA, and I should mention that the EPA budget, I don't know how this breaks down, but probably less than half of that pays for EPA offices, staff, and so on. A large part of it goes to pay for infrastructure grants for state and local governments, water treatment systems, drinking water systems. Another large chunk goes to support state environmental agencies, and then the remainder goes to EPA. So we're shrinking all of that by 7%. The state agency cuts were restored, so that's been protected. The infrastructure grants have been largely protected, not entirely, so that most of that cut comes out of that last piece, the EPA operating budget. So that's more like 9 to 10% for EPA across the board. That level of cut would be one of the deepest cuts that EPA has taken in any one year in the last 20 years. Is the slide? Yeah, if you can see the slide here, I hope you can read it. I think the important line you should see is the red line. That is EPA's budget over time adjusted for inflation. And I don't actually know what's going on back there in the 70s. I think they were figuring out the accounting. you can see that from the then there was a low point, a very low point. In the early 80s, the Reagan administration, that was sort of the last catastrophe we face. Then it was restored in the 1990s up through about the mid-2000s, more or less flat. And then it started declining. The last couple of years of the Bush administration, pretty deep cuts, about percentage-wise, about the same 7%, but from a high point. So it's starting to decline. And you, if you look at that red line on the right, it's basically a declining curve since about 2006, 2007. There was a big spike there, which was in part stimulus money, but that was really just a 1 or 2 year spike, and then the decline continued. So where we are right now, 2017, is actually much lower than what you, if you look to sort of what is the historical reference, that period 1990 to mid 2000s, we're considerably below that right now. And Congress is proposing to take a 7% cut below that. On this slide, the green line shows the Trump proposal, which is, you know, takes you back to the 1970s. If you go back and look at where does that cross the red line, the the proposal that just passed the House is better, but it goes back. This would be the lowest budget in real money, real terms, since 1986. And if you think about everything that EPA has to do now that it didn't have to do in 1986, basically everything that most of our climate work, you know, has obviously come on since then. We have many other responsibilities since then. So this is taking us back in real dollar terms to 1986 with all the additional responsibilities that we have. So I know I want, if there's one thing you walk away with, I want it to be that the budget that has been reported out is still a disastrous budget for EPA. And I will say that at that, that was voiced at the hearing yesterday. And I think we will hear more about this in the coming months. So that's what I wanted to do to set up, is to give you that context. Then I think the next speakers will take it into sort of what's actually happening in the policy world and in the programs.
Thank you. Thank you, George. Our next speaker is Bob Sussman. Bob served in the Obama administration from 2009 to 2013 as co-chair of the transition team for the EPA and then as senior policy counsel to the EPA administrator. He was a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress in 2008, writing and speaking about climate change and energy. He previously served in the Clinton administration as the EPA deputy administrator. He is now an adjunct faculty at Georgetown Law Center and Yale Law School, and is a consultant on the consultant on energy and environmental policy. Bob, please come up.
Good to be here, and good to have the air conditioning on a very, very hot and unpleasant day. I wanted to thank the Blue-Green Alliance for the invitation to be here today. I also wanted to give a shout-out to Safer Chemicals Healthy Families. I've worked with Safer Chemicals throughout the gory and arduous process of TSCA reform, and now through the even more arduous process of implementing the new law. And I think Safer Chemicals has been a real leader here, and we wouldn't be where we are today were it not for the work that they did, and of course many, many other organizations did on the new law. I do want to move into the realm of policy, as George indicated, and talk about where we are in the implementation of the new TSCA law and what we need to worry about. There's quite a bit that we need to worry about as each day we learn more about the approach of the Trump EPA, and more things happen that are troubling and disturbing. The issue with the chemicals program at this point is not funding. It's not being pinched the way other parts of EPA are. The issue is leadership and impartiality and integrity of decision making. And I think that we are moving towards a bad point in the implementation of this law, where many of the things that we hope would be accomplished under the law are biting the dust and show no sign of getting done. And I think there's a very real risk here that 3 or 4 years down the line, we're going to take a look at this program and we're going to say it's a failure, that it hasn't really accomplished what any of us wanted it to accomplish. I don't want to say that it's a lost cause, but I do want to say that I am personally very concerned about what lies ahead with the chemical safety program. If you had asked me about TSCA and the chemical safety program a year ago, I would have been actually pretty upbeat, because I think the last 8 or 9 years have been a period of significant progress. We've seen states step forward with more proactive chemical safety programs. That's been, I think, a very heartening development. We've seen developments in the marketplace with large retailers like Walmart being more sensitive than in the past to consumer concerns about chemicals and more willing to pressure their suppliers. And then at the Obama EPA, I think we saw a revival of TSCA that was very encouraging, an effort to breathe new life into a program that everybody felt was moribund, and some really impressive accomplishments, including standing up a program of chemical risk assessments, getting risk assessments done on a number of significant chemicals, something that had never really happened in the 40-year-plus history of the program. So I would have said that the stars were aligning a year ago. We did make it through the legislative process on the new law. I think that happened largely because the chemical industry felt threatened by some of the developments that I'm describing and came to the table somewhat reluctantly, and that resulted in a difficult bipartisan negotiation, but one in the end that put a new law on the president's desk, which, as we all know as we watch the Congress every day, is no mean feat. It's a real legislative accomplishment. The law is not everything that the public health community wanted by any means. It is a compromise, as you would expect, given the political dynamic. The industry was very tenacious in its lobbying, and got some of the things that it wanted. But having said all of that, I think that on paper, this is a pretty good law. Not a perfect law, but a pretty good law. And I think it does give, EPA some significant tools to look at the risks of commercially significant chemicals, to identify those risks, and then to restrict those chemicals in order to eliminate the risk. So EPA definitely has something to work with here, but the rub at EPA and anywhere else is whether there is the political will and the backbone to implement a law in a way that does move the needle on public health, but also takes on chemicals and companies and trade associations who don't want to see anything happen. And so the critical question is whether there is a commitment to impartiality, a commitment to objective science, and a commitment to staying the course and going wherever the science leads. And that's where I think we need to be very concerned about what we're seeing from the Trump EPA. And I think the larger picture there is that Scott Pruitt's vision, as many of you know, is that regulation is bad, environmental risks are overblown, industry needs regulatory relief, and everything that the Obama EPA did is suspect and needs to be deep sixed. And translated to the TSCA program, what this means is paying lip service to the need for effective implementation. You will hear the chemical industry say, you know, we support implementing the law that Congress passed, but at the same time, more quietly, making the law toothless and then paying acute attention to what industry wants and to cater to that industry agenda. We saw some early evidence of this when Scott Pruitt named Dr. Nancy Beck to be the Deputy Assistant Administrator for the Toxics and Pesticides Program. Nancy was a senior advocate at the American Chemistry Council for 5 years, and this is basically what she worked on. I mean, she worked on chemical safety and chemical regulation, and if you look through the record, as Eve and others have done, you'll see that Nancy was a prime mover in writing the ACC comments on some of the early actions under the new law. She spoke on behalf of ACC at public meetings that EPA held, and she testified in Congress in opposition to EPA's approaches to science. Now she's at EPA. With all of that background as a prime mover in the chemical industry's chemical agenda. To make things a little worse, EPA used what I would say is a somewhat unorthodox hiring mechanism to bring her into the agency, and the result of that is that she was told that she did not need to sign the Trump ethics pledge, which is not as good as the Obama ethics pledge, but it's certainly a step in the direction of eliminating conflicts of interest. And so I think we are now in a situation where she has free rein to do pretty much what she wants, including meet with ACC, make decisions on the basis of the ACC comments, work on the industry agenda very, very, very openly. And she is, for now, essentially running the toxics program at EPA. She's the highest ranking political appointee at the agency, and we see her imprint in everything that the agency does. The first tangible evidence of this is the rules that EPA finalized just a couple of weeks ago. These are the so-called framework rules that lay the groundwork under the new law for setting priorities and doing risk evaluations. We thought that the Obama EPA proposed rules were really quite good, but the final rules that were issued were very, very different and went in a very troubling direction on a number of key issues, and not coincidentally track the ACC comments and recommendations almost to a T. So we know that Nancy Beck was busy translating the work that she did at EPA into the contents of these final rules. And there are a couple of things about these rules that are disturbing. I won't go into depth, but one thing is that the proposed rules reflected a comprehensive approach to risk evaluations in which EPA would consider the uses and exposure pathways across the chemicals life cycle, and when they got done with the risk evaluation, it would be pretty definitive and address all the different concerns that might exist about the chemical. EPA has now reversed field on that. They've said that they are going to be selective in doing these risk evaluations. They're going to pick and choose which exposures and which uses they look at. And so, therefore, there's, I think, a very big risk here that when these evaluations are done, we won't really have the bottom line on these chemicals, and we may also find that pathways of exposure that we are concerned about, that vulnerable populations are concerned about, are not being addressed. So that's one concern. Another concern is testing and data gaps. I think people in this room all appreciate the fact that even some of the largest volume chemicals have significant data gaps where we don't know what we need to know about hazard, we don't know what we need to know about exposure, and the new law recognized that problem and gave EPA additional authority to require testing and the expectation that more testing would be done. But the signal that we're getting from these final rules is that the new EPA has very little interest in using the new testing authority and very little appetite to require industry to generate additional data. And then there's science and the new rules seem to fixate on some buzzwords that are in the new law, like weight of the evidence and best available science, and to use them as a stalking horse for industry's science agenda. So this is all very disappointing and does not augur well. I'd like to shift gears and talk about the three Section 6A rules that EPA proposed, because I think these rules go to the heart of the challenge that we have with this new administration. These are rules that basically ban certain high-exposure uses of methylene chloride, trichloroethylene, and bromopropane. These are chemicals that are data-rich in many respects, and they have been shown to have multiple adverse effects harm to reproductive systems, birth defects, cancer, in the case of methylene chloride, neurological damage that actually can lead to death by workers who are using methylene chloride paint removers. And the exposures are actually quite great to these particular uses. These are not controlled uses, and the exposed population consists of tens of thousands of workers, quite literally, and millions of consumers. You're going to be hard-pressed to find chemical uses that have this level of population exposure. And as you might expect, EPA has done a risk assessment, which for all three of these chemicals, which shows quite high calculated risks, levels of cancer and non-cancer risk, which are above the thresholds that EPA traditionally uses to define when risks are unacceptable. So you would think that these rules are a no-brainer. You would think that this is exactly what EPA ought to be doing under the new rule, under the new law. But I think right now we believe that EPA is not going to finalize these rules. Instead, they are going to fold them into the more comprehensive risk evaluations that it's doing on these chemicals, and the end result of that is rules that could be put in place right now and provide immediate public health protection are going to be sitting on the shelf for 6, 7, 8 years without any action. And even though I'm not a toxicologist, my sense is that the impact of delaying these rules is not going to be theoretical. It's going to be real. It's going to affect real people. There are workers who use paint removers containing methylene chloride that will die. There are workers that are dying right now from using methylene chloride paint removers, and that's going to continue. So all of us who want the new law to succeed need to be defending these proposed rules and doing whatever we can to keep them alive. I think quite honestly, if these rules are killed, it will speak volumes about the Trump administration and their true approach to implementing this new law. So I think I'm going to stop there if I can, and make a few concluding comments. I know that this is a bleak picture, and I wish it weren't, but I think the handwriting is really on the wall here, and this is the difficult reality that we are contending with. There are some good things happening outside of the federal government. I think the states keep moving ahead, and states that have strong chemical programs are looking at EPA and saying we need to stay the course here. We need to keep moving forward. That's a positive thing. Another positive thing is that in the marketplace, from what I understand from the work of Safer Chemicals and others, there are big retailers who remain very sensitive to concerns about chemicals and are stepping up and putting pressure on some of their suppliers. So that's a really good thing. But I think on the federal side right now, we just sort of need to grit our teeth and to dig in for the long haul. And I do think it's very important that the groups in this room and other groups really hold the administration's feet to the fire. I know that there's a temptation, I feel it myself, to sort of throw in the towel and walk away and say, well, this is all just a big waste of time. But I think at the end of the day, if groups like these groups don't hold EPA accountable, no one is going to do that. And I think in the end, accountability is the most important thing. So I will stop there and thank you very much.
Bob, I am just shocked to hear you say that you don't think the ACC's top priority is the public's health. That is just so contrary to everything I've heard before.
I know. We'll talk about that.
Yeah, okay. I told you not to go off script. Now we're going to turn to some of the workers' representatives. We have two unions represented here who have EPA workers as their members. The first we're going to hear from is AFGE, where Steve Hopkins, the first vice president of the AFGE Council 238 Executive Board, is going to address us. That executive board coordinates bargaining and other activity among AFGE's locals, representing workers all across the country. Steve previously was a member of AFGE Local 3331 right here in D.C., which represents the workers at the EPA headquarters. Thank you.
Good morning. I represent the American Federation of Government Employees at EPA. AFGE represents roughly 70% of the workforce at EPA that is subject to collective bargaining. We have locals all over the country in each of the 10 regions and 4 laboratories. So my remarks come from that. My own background, I worked in the Office of Pesticide Programs prior to coming to work for the federal government. I worked in private industry. So in private industry, I went to my customers. I said, all these regulations, they are so bad, they are so terrible, they are so onerous, we need to increase our price 10%. And we got the 10%. We had an environmental surcharge. At the same time, I was in the wood treating business. We used creosote, pentachlorophenol, arsenic, you name it. At the same time, we were cleaning up our act. And we went to zero discharge. And we found out, gee, we're not only making 10% on this side, we're making 3 or 4% on the other side, too. This environmental, this is a pretty good deal. We complain about the regulations, we make more money. Now, that's good for everybody, isn't it? Now, I have spent my entire career at the interface between industry and the environment. I have heard this mantra over and over again, jobs versus environment. It wasn't true then, it isn't true now. I have heard, oh, we can't afford to do this, and the griping about government regulation, but the fact is that government regulation is often what creates our market, what keeps competition out, and we need to come back and look at what is really free enterprise and say free enterprise is fine, but let's pick up all the costs and let's take care of the people in the process. Now, I do want to give out a shout to Betty McCollum, who through every administration has defended our budget, defended EPA, and she happens to be the representative from where I was before I moved to Washington, D.C., St. Paul, Minnesota. We have had the benefit at EPA of having support sufficient on both sides of the aisle to maintain our funding and maintain our role. What I get concerned about in representing the workers at EPA is that if we get short-sheeted in terms of staff, what happens is we do the best we can with what we've got. So if you come up and you say, gee, doing a pesticide re-registration should take approximately 12 hours of work, and then they tell you you've got to do three a day, you've got to do three a day. Quality out the window. I have represented people at EPA. I went into one meeting with the supervisor one time. He was doing pesticide re-registrations, and he had to read, in this case, 1,500 pages. His supervisor told him, you don't need to read, just sign it. All I need is the signature. Because when you come back and look at it, what you can come back on EPA for is not following the process. You can't come back on EPA about the outcome. And because of EPA, you can't come back on the manufacturer because they said, gee, in the case of pesticides, EPA said that it represented no unreasonable risk. Therefore, go talk to EPA. EPA goes back and looks, and they say, oops, you signed that piece of paper. So you're at fault. We're going to fire you, and that takes care of our problem. No, it doesn't take care of the problem. The problem is exposure. The problem is exposure to vulnerable populations, and what EPA is supposed to do is to be the gatekeeper. We have enjoyed support from a broad base of people, and frankly, as people working in the agency, we have come to assume that instead of go out and defend it. And I think the agency has failed to defend their brand as being a scientifically based brand. And we have to get back and defend that. From my standpoint in the union, I'm going to want to give you a little test. All right. How many people, looking back to the Kennedy administration in 1962, how many federal employees do we have now compared to what we had in 1962? How many people say we had more? We have more federal employees now than we did in 1962. You agree? How many people say we have less? How many people say we have the same? In fact, we have the same. But in 1962, EPA did not exist. In 1962, we didn't have a tremendous number of World War, we had World War II veterans, but they weren't retirement age, they weren't getting old. We didn't have to have the size in VA. We didn't have Iraq and Afghanistan that has put more burden on EPA, and we didn't even think about TSA. But we have the same number of federal employees. Now, there is a difference between a federal employee and a contractor, and we've been reading a lot about that in the paper lately. Because the federal employee takes an oath of office to uphold and defend the Constitution of the United States of America, the same oath that we had the president take up on the podium. But that means they have a long-term stake in the job that they're doing. They want to be able to do the job that they're doing. We had a situation after 9-1-1 where somebody from EPA made the mistake to say that the dust could be a very serious health issue. They got fired. 13 years later, they got their job back. That's two administrations. 13 years later, they got their job back, and the agency that said, that's fine, we'll pay you. We're not putting you to work, but we'll pay you. She had to go back to court to try to get work, and of course, if you're into labor law at all, it is management's exclusive right to assign you work. So if they choose to not assign you work, that's their choice. But she went back to court, and somebody said to her, what does it feel like to be an advocate, an activist? She said, I'm not an activist. I'm a chemist. I was hired to do chemistry. What I want to do is do the chemistry. I want to do it right, and I want to stand by my science. That's what we have to push for as American people. if we come up and we find out something is a hazard, but then we find out that because of the breadth and scope and how much it would impact the country, we can't regulate it to that level, that's fine. That's the political decision, but we need to base it on sound science. And if every one of us isn't out there pushing to maintain the sound science and then make the political decisions, whatever we have to do accordingly, we'll be lost. The fact of the matter is that right now, with the same number of federal employees that we had in 1962, we've got to come back and say, what are we doing? And what you will see, what I'm afraid of at EPA, is that everything is going to rock along just fine. If they tell you you need to do three reviews a day, you can do three. If they tell you five, you can do five. If they tell you just sit here and sign the paper, we will get down to that. You'll sit there and sign the paper. Then you'll have something like the Gulf oil spill happen, and you will find out that you've got 300 oil wells in the Gulf, that most of those oil wells had the same spill plan. But the spill plan came from Alaska, and they didn't even bother to go through and white out the names, because the people were so overburdened that they were not able to do their job, and there was no expectation of doing their job. But when something happens, we come back and say, that employee screwed up. We have some issues just coming to the surface now with some pesticides that were approved. Somebody went back and found some emails that there may have been an effort to support that. But we know we have pesticides right now that are out there, atrazine for one. We have been studying atrazine for 10 years. And as long as we can keep it in the study phase and keep saying we're studying it, we don't have to do anything about it. But at the same time, we know that atrazine is a problem, and we know the levels of atrazine in Lake Michigan are going up, that atrazine doesn't break down in cold water. And if you know Lake Michigan is cold water, you also might know that it's what? It in itself is about 5% of the world's freshwater supply. Lake Superior is 10%. The Great Lakes altogether are 20% of the whole world's freshwater supply. And we've got atrazine levels at Lake Michigan that are a concern. That should be a concern. Now, the area that I worked in and where I think we got to look and go is, one, we have to have the employees out there ready, willing, and able to take the battle on, and we have to hold them to high expectation. An awful high percentage of the people that I represented and tried to defend their jobs were trying to do their job. Now, I had some in there, and frankly, I sat down once or twice and said, look, if I'd been your supervisor, I would have fired you. You need to do what they tell you to do. If you're not willing to do that, I can't defend you as a union representative. But when we come back, as we've seen now, and we take away or talk about taking away collective bargaining, we talk about taking away civil service protections, and we have for the VA, we are going back to a situation where you do what your boss says or you're out. So you come up in the situation you're confronted with is, do I shut up and get by and continue to feed my family, or do I just go out and look for another job? Do I want to be the designated felon? In my career, I've been asked to be the designated felon, and I decided I didn't want to work for that company. But we're putting federal employees into a position where you put up and shut up. And when you do that, quality goes way down. And if you tell somebody you've got 10 times more work to do than you can possibly do, quality goes way down. And if you come back and you quiet the press and you eliminate whistleblower protections, you eliminate union protections, then a person says, well, I have no options, because I can't get the word out. I can't do anything. The situation where the supervisor told me, just shut up and sign it. You don't have to read the review. You just need to sign it. I took that to the EPAIG. And the EPAIG took it, and he gave that information to the director of pesticide programs. And the director of pesticide programs said, that's not a problem. End the conversation right there. So if we're looking to the IG as going to keep the agency honest, it isn't going to happen. if we're looking to employees to keep doing their job and do the job that Congress paid them to do and the oath of office that they took, we take an oath of office to the people of the United States to uphold and defend the Constitution. I did not take an oath of office to defend my boss, to defend this administration, or any other administration. We work for the American people and try to do the mission that Congress gave us to do. When we had the shutdown, I went out and I said, just let us go to work. That's all we want to do, is let us work, do the job you're paying us for, and get us out of the game playing. That's what we need out of our federal employees. The unions are extraordinarily important in defending the ability of the federal employee to do the job that Congress gave us to do. There is talk now of changing and redefining representation, because one of the things the unions have been able to do is to go directly to Congress. Go in, and here we have had several sit-downs with the congressmen and the senators and their staffs on issues that have come up at EPA, and we have been very well received. But if they're successful in taking that definition of representation away, doing away with official time, and doing away with unions, employees will not be able to do that. We will not have control over what government does. We used to have a joke that the Pentagon was built in that particular round shape so everybody could stand there like that. We have to worry about that. And with that, I'll stop. The takeaway is we have the same number of federal employees now we did in 62. We have a job to do. We need to be able to do it. And to be able to do it, we need the ability to speak to Congress and collective bargaining. Thank you.
Steve, the minute I met you, I knew there was something special, and it's because our headquarters is in Minneapolis, so obviously you were meant to be here with us today. Next, I am very honored, very, very honored to introduce a former colleague of mine. Kurt Vondren is a legislative rep for the National Treasury Employees Union. NTEU is the largest independent federal sector labor union, representing over 150,000 federal workers in 31 different agencies and departments. Prior to his work at NTEU, Kurt served as public policy and political action role for a variety of progressive organizations, including the International Union of Electronic Workers, where we were together, and the National Council of Senior Citizens. Kurt, please come on stage.
Thank you, Lauren. Very happy to be here. As Lauren mentioned, NTEU, we represent 31 different federal agencies. Like my brothers and sisters in the steel workers, we have organized outside our original industry of the Treasury Department. And before I get into the EPA, which I want to talk about, just some of the other agencies where we represent the employees at the Department of Energy. And you may recall during the transition, this administration tried to compel the Department of Energy to turn over a list to the transition team of all of the employees there who worked on climate change. And I'm proud to say that NTEU pushed back on that. And I think one of the few times that the Trump administration has even come close to apologizing for something. They didn't quite fully apologize, but closer than they have on any other occasion. We also represent the employees of the Food and Drug Administration, which play an important role in keeping our food, medical devices, and pharmaceuticals safe. And what I think is underappreciated at Customs and Border Protection, it would probably scare you if you were aware of the number of mislabeled products coming through the ports of entry in this country, chemicals, pesticides, machinery, and other things, of which 1% are inspected by our members. We had yesterday Congressman David Price of North Carolina propose an amendment in the Appropriations Committee to move funding from this somewhat misguided administration proposal to build a wall. and instead have those funds put to hiring more men and women to work at Customs. Sadly, that did not pass, but we're going to continue to try to do the work to increase staffing to make sure that, you know, as we make sure here in this country that toxins and chemicals and pesticides are safe, that those standards aren't undermined by products coming across the border that are falsely labeled. But let me talk a little bit about the EPA. Along with our brothers and sisters in AFGE, we represent a number of the employees at headquarters, at Region 9, which is the San Francisco office, as well as the Cincinnati laboratory. And we were very dismayed at the beginning of this year when the new administration proposed a 31% budget cut at the Environmental Protection Agency, which would have meant the loss of between 3,200 and maybe as many as 4,000 jobs. This was not a minor staff reduction. This, our members there made very clear to us at the National Union, would not just mean that there would be some loss through attrition, that people might have to, you know, step up and work a little harder. But when you have a reduction in staff of that proportion, it's very, very clear that whole programs would have to be ended. You just cannot continue to do the work with that reduced staff. And the administration's announcement I was incredibly demoralizing for the employees there. They are on the front lines, and they see the practical impact of their work, and they know about the life-saving importance of the work that they do. Having said that, I want to say that the employees at the EPA are incredibly grateful for the support they have received from the environmental community since the president announced his intention to make these cuts. The March for Science was a great event, of which we were very gave the employees there a great morale boost. And there have been recently a series of both spontaneous and organized events in front of EPA offices, both here in Washington and in the field. But with the environmental community coming forward, greeting our members as they come to work or as they go to lunch, with handwritten thank you notes, hugs, particularly appreciated ice cream, muffins, cookies. You know, the great work that the Blue-Green Alliance does is kind of bringing together the labor movement and the environmental community, which sometimes move in different circles. And we have gotten over some of the stereotypes we have had. I was at one of these events. I enjoyed the ice cream, but let me say the organic, vegan, sugarless muffin wasn't all that bad either. Not to stereotype environmentalist. But, no, I mean, this our members were incredibly demoralized, and those events really had a profound impact in making them feel that the citizens of this country, despite what the new administration was saying, the citizens of this country really understood and appreciated the work they did. So for those of you in the environmental community and environmental movement, thank you very much for what was done. It had a tremendous impact, and we at NTU, and I know our brothers and sisters at AFGE, made sure that even those members who did not directly participate in these events were aware of them. We sent out our photos. It was just great. But I also, you know, I want to make clear that while many of the employees at EPA have this very, very strong commitment to the environment, the typical EPA employee I have found does not quite fit the tree hugger stereotype of many environments. They are scientists. They are science majors, chemistry majors. They are not liberal arts majors. They are not, a lot of them, terribly political people. And they have a craft. They have a professional skill, and they want to do that job. And for many of them, it's incredibly puzzling why their work is under attack by this new administration. They understand what they are doing is science. They are testing chemicals. They are, it's all over my head. I can't understand most of it, but I mean, they are chemists, they are researchers, they are toxicologists, and they are just absolutely brilliant professionals in their field. And it has been incredibly demoralizing for them to have their profession, their professional skills under attack when they are simply doing their job to try to protect the citizenry of this country. So NTU, and we're going to continue to do our work, and we're grateful for the support of groups like this and the rest of the labor and the environmental community to try to make sure that the administration's attempts to cut back on the EPA are not successful. We're very happy that we have made some progress already with the House Appropriations Committee in at least reducing the amount of the cut. We're going to continue to work in the Senate to try to further narrow that. But, we know that citizens, environmentalists, the labor movement, all working together, that we have a good hope of getting the administration to back down on this. So thank you.
Okay, so if my staff can get the microphones to take around for the Q&A, that would be great. And I will start you off. Even if you miraculously, have the entire budget restored, they've already started to implement buyout programs for retirement, and my guess is they won't backfill any of those positions. So you could see, tell me if I'm wrong, you could see some significant loss of ability to do the EPA's mission just from that. You all should have microphones on your
Bob. No, I think, Lauren, that's a very troubling point, is that the administration has already begun to pursue buyouts. We're not clear how many employees will take these buyouts, but the huge number of federal employees are already retirement eligible. So it is very likely that we will see over 1,000 employees take a buyout. We don't know where it will come from, what offices, what bureaus of EPA, but this is it's a very troubling way of getting to the administration's agenda with sidetracking Congress.
Yeah, and I'm sorry. Go ahead, Bob.
Yeah, I was going to say that one effect of a mass exodus of EPA employees is that there's a tremendous loss of expertise and institutional knowledge and experience, and that really creates cracks in the environmental protection system, which are very difficult to repair because continuity is very important in an organization like EPA that does difficult technical and legal work and has a whole significant body of regulations on the books. The other thing I would relate here is that for EPA employees faced with the decision to take a buyout or to stay at the agency, they are in a very difficult place. The dilemma that they face is a very serious dilemma. And I've talked to folks I know who are still at the agency, and George may have done that as well. And some of them are people who had intended to make a career at EPA, who were looking at becoming SES members, and now they're really agonized. And the question is, do they stay at an agency where they're not really going to be able to contribute, or do they cut their losses and leave? And the implications of that for the quality of the EPA workforce on a long-term basis, I think, are very serious.
I was just going to add that this is one of the things that really concerns us about the budget that came out of the House Appropriations Committee. Although the money cut is not nearly as deep as in the administration's proposed, they still seem to be anticipating very sizable reductions in numbers of staff. There is a number in there for what they call workforce, it's Orwellian. It's like workforce improvement or something like that. It means money to buy up, and they reduced it. But there's like $58 million in there for this workforce adjustment, and that's signaling, no, that they still anticipate 1,000, maybe 2,000 people retiring or leaving early because of this, which, you know, it's been said before, if you have the money but you don't have the staff, you're not going to get the work done.
Is it on? I caution a little bit that some of these trends are not administration specific. And there's a tendency on people who have been involved in this, myself included, to say, oh, Trump, Trump, Trump. But there has been a lot of pressure for a long time to reduce the number of federal employees at any expense, replace them with contractors. A contractor is only responsible to his work order, period. His task is to make profit for his company. And so I feel that one is that the EPA has contracted out too often their core business and their core knowledge and done their institutional knowledge by contract. The senior people who had the depth and expertise and really grew up in that, the PhDs, are being replaced with people with bachelor degrees who are being turned into contract management people. Regardless of what their job title is, what they're really doing is kind of looking at somebody else's work and signing it off. And what we need are the core of experienced, educated, technical people who understand the field that they're working in. And when we have moved and we even, at EPA, we even have contractors now auditing other contractors. And then they provide a recommendation to the agency and somebody signs off on it, and that becomes the inherently governmental decision. That is a long-term trend, and we need to be very concerned about it. We need to be concerned that we can't tie the people to the work that needs to be done, because the number of people comes from Congress independently of the funds. So when somebody looks at doing their job, if you haven't got money for people, you go hire a contractor and do the best you can. We haven't staffed Department of Justice properly to really oversee the contract. So one of the first things you learn in administering contracts is you don't have a problem with a contract. Because if you do, it's not going to get resolved in your favor. And I think these trends go beyond a little bit beyond one administration, and one administration can come in and put their slant on it. Another administration can come in and put it back. We need to make sure that there is a core there of government agencies that are doing the job that Congress gave them to do, and that there's oversight of that job, and that there diminishes the swing from one administration to the next.
Thank you. Questions out from the audience? Anybody?
Hello, I'm from South Texas, and there's a reservation there, nature reservation, Santa Ana, and it was proposed, I don't know, there's some articles floating around, that is where the border wall would start its construction. Someone had mentioned shifting some of the funds to increase the border force. Have you considered working with environmental protection, I mean, not the EPA, but I guess other nature conservation lobbyist groups, and work together to maybe influence it to kind of conserve some of these nature reservations as well?
We should be. NTU represents the customs officers. So these are the people who staff the ports of entry, not the Border Patrol, which is another union. But, yes, that would be something that would be very helpful to us. We're convinced that where the need is more customs officers inspecting the imports, the materials coming into this country. As I said, right now only 1% is being inspected. Many of these are mislabeled products, chemicals, pesticides, industrial equipment that are unsafe. And because of a lack of staff and support, they're not being inspected. It would be a much better use of taxpayer dollars than the construction of the border wall. But so I appreciate that.
And when you ask a question, if you wouldn't mind giving your name and organization, too. Thank you. Other questions? Over here. Can you get him the mic?
I'm Kaylin.
Okay, here we go.
I'm with the Environmental Defense Fund. I think my question is perhaps more geared for Steve Hopkins. My question was, how do you see regulations as keeping businesses and industry competitive?
Regulations create a significant barrier to entry to somebody else wanting to get into that business. And you have to have a certain degree of expertise to navigate that that tends to keep competition out. Regulations also give you, as you heard me explain, a marketing term that you can go to people and say, oh, I need an environmental surcharge, and you can blame some of your price increases on the environment because it's a good dog to kick. And you may get some of your money, and, you know, the purpose is to increase your margin as much as you can. Now, the fact of the matter is that I think, and I feel very strongly on this, that industry needs a good set of regulations that is enforced uniformly that creates a level playing field. If I am a large producer, and we were a very large producer of railroad cross ties, and I have to follow the standard because I'm a big company, and then mom and pop can set up and do none of that and get by, I can't compete with that. And so I believe industry looks at that to create consistency in the field, to create a level playing field so that they can work. Now, if industry gets a chance to tilt that table a little in their favor, they certainly will, but that's what people need to be around to watch. I think that the regulations are important as a benefit to industry, and it also certainly reduces industry's liability. If you're following the law and somebody comes up and says that caused a problem, hey, I followed the law. Now, in my own background, my grandfather worked in the paint room at Chrysler long before OSHA ever existed. And within 10 years, he got leukemia and died, as did everybody else who worked in the paint room for that period of time. So when we come up and we say, oh, all these onerous regulations, we need to get rid of them, all that's doing is pushing that cost back to individuals and saying, well, you know, you chose to work in the paint room. You chose to have a job. Therefore, that's what you get for it.
Let me
address another aspect of your question. I think that in many respects, innovation stimulates regulation, and coming around from the other side, regulation stimulates innovation. And I say that because many of the most successful EPA regulations have ridden the wave of emerging technologies that are beginning to replace old and unsafe and polluting technologies and processes. And the regulation turns out to be the very push that is needed to get the new technology accepted in the marketplace. Conversely, regulations stimulate innovation because industry is obviously looking for the lowest cost path to compliance. And so somebody who can cut costs on compliance by offering an innovative type of pollution control equipment or a process which is less polluting to begin with, and therefore is more effective in meeting the requirements of the regulations, that new process is going to have an opportunity in the marketplace due to regulation that would not exist otherwise.
Yeah, it is amazing how that word has taken on such a negative connotation, and we have to fight back against that. The gentleman over here had a question.
Joseph Bressel from Johns Hopkins. There was a comment made about the framework rules and that the scenarios of exposure assessment were being changed. But and yet the National Academy of Sciences has a red book on how risk assessment should be conducted with governing rules, I guess, regarding how exposure assessment is conducted. I was just curious how, what would the National Academy of Sciences say regarding these new scenarios? And it really goes against the science, if you will, of risk assessment.
I'm not an expert toxicologist the way Jen Sass, for example, is, but what's very interesting to me is that TCE in particular has undergone very extensive not only assessment but peer review of the assessments that have been conducted by the EPA Science Advisory Board, and then actually by the National Academy of Sciences, which issued a significant report on TCE. So we need to be, I think, very wary of assertions that are made that EPA is not using the best available science when the work that EPA does on these chemicals derives, first of all, from an extensive body of data and scientific literature, but even more importantly, has been vetted very, very carefully by high-quality scientists who are not affiliated with the agency. And I would say on TCE that given the decade plus of review and peer assessment of EPA's work on TCE, it's time to close the book on TCE and move on to action.
Does anybody from the next panel, as long as this is being raised, want to make a comment on the question? No? Okay, great. Over here.
Hi. My name is Emma Sullivan. I'm studying, I'm doing a Master of Public Health at George Washington in Environmental Health Science and Policy. And my question is, for those of us just starting out our careers, in which direction do you recommend we go in order to have the greatest impact?
Oh, wow, nobody's volunteering.
This is sort of like one of our union members comes to me asking for retirement advice and stuff like that. I've also, one of the issues our union's been working on is paid family leave for federal employees. And again, when I discuss that issue, I always preface it by saying, I'm just talking about legislation. Any of you who are already on the road to that, I can't really make any guarantees for you. So it's a tough question. I can tell you that I have talked to many of federal employees who have found their work incredibly rewarding, and it's been an opportunity to apply their skills and the craft, the profession that they know, in a way that makes a real difference to better society, to better environment, to better this country and the world. So I know there's challenges right now, but I would not discourage anyone from coming into public service. It is a wonderful way to have an impact on this world. And what you're doing as a civil servant, your job for this country and for our society, both of our unions will be there to protect your pay and your benefits and one day your retirement. So that part of it, hope, you know, you will have a defender for as you apply your skills to public service.
Yep. Okay. This question over there. Thank you.
Hi, everyone. My name's Corrine Taylor. I'm with We Act for Environmental Justice. My question is sort of just a follow-up on with what Mr. Hopkins was saying about the role of contract employees in federal work. How do we ensure that they actually are motivated by the missions of the agency versus the goals or, I guess, policies of the companies? Because if there's going to be more contract employees, say, at the EPA, they may not really be aligned with the focus of protecting public health and the environment. So what kind of procedures are in place to ensure that their work does align with the mission of the agency?
Well, I'm going to give you an answer that's somewhat biased by my own experience in that. Very early in my career, I had a little discussion with a contracting officer where I told a contractor to stop work, and under the federal regulations, somebody can't just go up and tell a contractor to stop work. I told him, look, I'm an expert in the environmental regulations, and gee, we've got 4 feet of shelf space that this takes up. If you take all the pages of the environmental regulation and put them together, he said, good, the FAR, the Federal Acquisition Regulation, has 14 feet of shelf space. The Federal Acquisition Regulation makes our environmental regulation look simple. I have had 2 cases in my career. In one case, the company was just absolutely committing fraud, and they had come to me with a whole bunch of hazardous waste manifests to sign, and stuff was misclassified. I refused to sign. They sued the government for delay of contract and used the same timesheets for the delay of contract that they had used to get paid for the original job. And so we worked up a whole pile of paperwork, and you understand that Department of Justice is the one who adjudicates those things. And when all that paperwork and all that work that we'd put into fighting this went to Department of Justice, they said, oh, it's only $40,000. It's not worth us to worry about. They paid it. The second one involves some tank removals. And in the end, the Department of Justice came back and said, oh, well, you should have moved to have that contractor disbarred. But before they did the work, I in particular had absolutely no experience with them and no basis to say they needed to be disbarred. And certainly no factual evidence to go to a court and say to the court, this contractor is so bad they should not be allowed to do business with the federal government. I had none of that. We ended up paying out $250,000 because of their shoddy work. It is a complex process. I don't think any company in the world would go out and contract out their core business. If it's something that you're going to be doing day in and day out, you want to have your own people doing it because then you have the experience of doing it. You know how to do it. You know how to do it effectively and efficiently. I got into a situation with the Air Force, and after Hurricane Katrina, one of the things that had come up in the Congress was that the Air Force has 2 aerial spray flight teams that spray for basically mosquitoes but other insects worldwide. If there is a malaria outbreak in Kenya, they will be over there and they will spray for mosquitoes. After Hurricane Katrina, the Air Force was asked to fly for filth flies and mosquitoes. The state of Louisiana had come to EPA, and we need to use the pesticide Naylid, and we need to use it at the rate of 4 ounces an acre. And EPA approved it. The Air Force was called in to spray, but the Air Force has been doing spraying at least since 1970, because that was when their regulations came in place that said this is how you do it to do it right. They have studied on droplet size. They have a GPS specially designed to fly the plane where the spray is going to end up. They ended up spraying, because we had a second hurricane immediately following that, they ended up spraying over 3.5 million acres. They sprayed that 3.5 million acres with between 0.5 ounce of Naylid and 1 ounce of Naylid an acre instead of the 4 ounces that EPA had approved. That was a huge savings. And we tried to get information for that in front of Congress, because Congress was saying, oh, gee, that you could contract that out. You don't need to have that expertise. You can contract that out. When they contracted out stuff in the Gulf War, the Army's pest management regulation is some 200 pages long. When they did a contract with Halliburton, they had 1 paragraph of 2 sentences talking about pest management in the whole contract. So that the standard that we had set for ourselves and our government employees was 200 pages. When we go to contract it out, we give them 1 paragraph of 2 sentences, and then we expect the same quality work to be done. It doesn't happen. the contractor in any case is only responsible for what you put in the scope of work. And the way the law has been determined is that if they can reasonably interpret it the way they interpret it, their interpretation is going to prevail. And so when the government goes to contract out, the government is at somewhat of a disadvantage in the first place. The second problem that you have with it is that you don't want to contract out your core business. You don't want to contract out things you have to do day in and day out because you want to develop the efficiencies of doing that and doing it right and doing it well. In the federal government, I have been amazed. I did come through the Department of Defense and working with them. The Department of Defense has been a very, very strong environmental partner with EPA. Has done a tremendous number of good things for the environment and working together quietly behind the scenes to do the right thing at the right time in the right place. That's one of the advantages that you have by having the people on the ground there knowing what you do. I can't emphasize, and you made the point, I just want to emphasize that you need people with the technical skill and technical expertise in those positions to correctly guide the agency and help make the right decision at the right time.
Great. Thank you. I want to thank the panel for sharing your time and expertise with us. As you noticed, I very carefully said we weren't going to take a scheduled break. I knew something would just flow. So we're going to take about a 10-minute break right now. If you're watching the time, we had a cancellation from Krista Egger. She unfortunately got a case of food poisoning. So that's why I let this run on a little long. And I would just invite the attendees sitting along the wall, if you want to be more comfortable, we definitely have open seats at some of the rounds over here. It's up to you if you want to move when you come back in. Thank you, guys. So we want to move on with the agenda. I'm going to do some introductions of our panel, and then we're going to do some Q&A with them, and then afterwards questions from the audience. So first I'd like to introduce Jen.
Order?
It doesn't matter, because I'll do the questions in my own order, so you can sit wherever. But I will do the introductions in the order of how they're seated. So immediately to my right is Jennifer Sass, the senior scientist for health programs at the National Natural Resources Defense Council. She brings a really highly specialized expertise in U.S. chemicals policy. Much of her work is focused on understanding and explaining the science behind toxic chemical regulation and advocating for regulations that are consistent with science, health policy, and environmental law, all three things which may be going away. I don't know. She frequently provides testimony and scientific briefings for members of Congress and federal advisory committees and is a lecturer at GW's Department of Environmental and Occupational Health. Next to her is Nika Leiba, the Director of Healthy Living Science for the Environmental Working Group. Nika has a passion for the environment and environmental issues. She joined EWG in 2006 and works on many toxic issues, including cosmetics and water quality. She has appeared on CNN and several local TV stations talking about consumer exposure to toxic chemicals and has been quoted in a wide range of national publications. All the way at the end is Eve Gartner, a litigator with the Healthy Communities Program at Earth Justice, where she has efforts to protect human health from toxic chemicals. Prior to joining Earth Justice, Eve spent more than 15 years as an attorney defending reproductive justice, including serving as the deputy director for litigation at Planned Parenthood Federation of America. Thank you, and welcome to our panelists. All right, I'm going to... So, I'm on. I'm going to ask a question that I'd like each of you to answer, which is, what are the biggest threats that you see on the toxic chemical forefront, and how has that outlook changed over the last year?
Eve, you want to start?
Sure. So I'm not sure this is exactly what you're getting at, but the biggest threat that I see are the regulatory rollbacks from the Trump administration. The Obama administration, albeit fairly late in the day, promulgated a bunch of very health protective regulations over the last few months of the administration, and several of those key regulations have been put on hold by the Trump administration, with the, you know, fairly transparent intent to roll them back. So two that I just wanted to mention. One of the rules that has been put on hold is what we refer to as the chemical disaster rule, which would protect workers and fence line communities by requiring facilities that store extremely hazardous chemicals to develop plans to prevent accidents. And right now in this country, over 1,000 people on average die per year in accidents related to chemicals at facilities. The Obama rule would have done a significant, taken significant steps to reduce those deaths, and the Trump administration has said, no, we're just putting this on hold indefinitely. A second rule that's been put on hold is one that would protect workers and communities from exposure to restricted use pesticides, which are by definition the most toxic pesticides that are used. There's a rule that's been on the books unchanged for 40 years that establishes training and other protections for applicators of these restricted use pesticides. The rule was unchanged for 40 years. It had never been updated. Finally, the Obama administration updated the rule, set a minimum age so that children couldn't be handling these very, very toxic pesticides, and established parameters for training workers that are going to be applying those pesticides. And that rule, too, has been put on hold indefinitely by the Trump administration. So I think those are just two examples of many, but these regulatory rollbacks, I think, are the biggest threat to, you know, protecting people from exposure to pesticides and chemicals.
Yeah, I think my answer is similar to Eve's. If you had asked me this question a year ago, it would probably be different. But under the current situation, definitely rollbacks of health protective measures and policies is one of the biggest threats. And we've seen it. As Eve said, she gave two great examples. But in the last 6 months, we've seen huge rollbacks of policies that are intended to keep source waters protected, headstreams in particular, waters that serve as a drinking water for more than 117 million people. We've seen slashes to the EPA budget, as we spoke about before. Perhaps it's not as much as the 30%+, but it's still a significant amount. And to be honest, we weren't coming from a place of plenty to begin with. It's not that we were overprotected, and so we can go to a place where we can lose a little protection. We weren't coming from that place, far from it. So to lose any protection, especially protection of our children, is disheartening. The fact that shortly after Scott Pruitt was nominated, we rescinded or reverse the ban on chlorpyrifos, a pesticide that the EPA studied for years, and found that even tiny amounts can be hazardous to children. It affects the brains of children. And right after his nomination, or close to his nomination, that was rescinded. That was a blow. And so the rollback of these protections, the protections of public health, the protections of our children, is definitely one of the biggest threats. Another big threat that is related is the continual nomination of people that have deep industry ties. So we saw that with Nancy Beck, and yesterday we saw the nomination of Michael Durson, who also has deep industry ties, and he'll be in the office of pesticide and chemicals. And the fact that he started a group, Terra, that is dedicated to undercutting chemical regulations, it's just it's so profoundly shocking that these are the people that will be running our chemical and pesticide programs, the ones that are dedicated to undercutting it. Jen?
It's not funny, but, you know, it's kind of...
If you don't laugh, you cry.
Exactly.
I'm going to be really... take a different tack. And I don't know if this will cheer anybody up or not, but I'm going to mention something that struck me when I had this question. Thank you. It's a great question. The question is, what have you seen in the past year? And I think that for science, this stuff has been building so that, I mean, I think like all the rollbacks, right? Like chlorpyrifos, which we've been working on for 25 years, and Earth Justice has sued for sure half a dozen times on that to hold them a timeline. So nothing in the last year came from nowhere. It's all stuff that's been building and planning. And so I'm going to go to the level of science and say that what concerns me the most and what has been rolling for the last decade and for sure has been, you know, built into a lot of the Tusk implementation and hit a lot of riders and stuff is the use of mechanistic action or mechanistic data or adverse outcome pathways. It's very obscure science, so I'm going to explain it in a second or two, but what it's used for is to undermine or dismiss or negate evidence of harm of these chemicals by saying we can't trust the toxicology or the epidemiology because we can't explain how that cancer is caused or how that pathway to a birth defect happen. And if we can't explain it, then we can't, you know, trust it or regulate it until we can explain it. The requirement or the over-reliance on mechanistic information, mechanistic data, cellular, you know, level data, it is being built into the implementation of all this stuff. So, for example, the EPA's Endocrine Disruptor Screening Program, EDSP, which Eve reminded me about a few minutes ago, has never called anything an endocrine disruptor, like nothing. Like atrazine has been run through it, like they've all been run through it. Well, atrazine they did think was an endocrine disruptor, but not through that program. So since that program has gotten off the ground, and we've also had to, you know, push that program to work, it hasn't called anything because one study at a time, these mechanistic studies are not evidence in themselves, and that's how they're being interpreted, one study at a time on their own. And what that means is that the animal data showing you take a rat, you treat it, it dies, you know, or whatever, its head falls off, its liver explodes. They're like, well, we don't really know how the liver exploded. It only exploded at this dose, but not that dose. Well, it exploded, but the high doses don't count because they were really high, too high than what people are exposed to. Or, you know, it only did it in the males and not the females, so I'm not sure why that wouldn't count, to be honest, but... This is the kinds of things that are being used to undermine the rodent studies and create doubt on them. The epidemiology, this is to me the saddest of all. These are people who are sick or died, depending on whether it's a mortality or morbidity study, some adverse endpoint. This is the saddest way to regulate. And most of these, of course, are worker studies because workers are exposed at the highest levels day in and day out, and we have good data on their exposures. We have, you know, industrial hygienists, we have occupational readings, we know exactly what they use, the chemicals they used are labeled, so they are the best kinds of studies from a scientific perspective, but the saddest way to regulate because it's too late for all those data points, right? Those data points are somebody's family members, somebody's loved ones, somebody's household support. So they're... That, in a sense, we used to think that that was the saddest way, but now with these new data, they're undermining that. So, for instance, formaldehyde. Everybody knows about formaldehyde, right? But where formaldehyde got attacked by the industry is that they said they can't explain the mechanism by which it causes leukemia. So even though we had National Cancer Institute, we had half a dozen different occupational studies showing high levels of leukemia in workers in different industries, working in embalming, working with plywood manufacturing, working in different industries, across industries, it didn't matter. They said we don't have the mechanistic data to explain it, and we think that the formaldehyde would rapidly volatilize in the nasal cavity. It wouldn't get into the bloodstream, and therefore you could never get leukemia. That was all based on no data, based on hypothesis, and that's how they held up the EPA's formaldehyde assessment. So that's been building for 10 years, and right now we are at the point where we are going to see how that gets built into implementation of TSCA, but it will have a huge effect.
Sounds like the administration could be very opportunistic as this stuff coincidentally is coming to a head. And they look for the, what's it called, the honest science that, you know, they have to all be made public. So though your organizations use many tactics in your fight for a toxic-free world, at least one stands out for each of that your organizations are well known for. Nika, there's tens of thousands of consumers who have gone on the Skin Deep website. It's really admirable. How have you been able to reach so many consumers and have so many listen and look up and make change and demand new products?
We've been shocked, to be honest, about the popularity of Skin Deep. When we developed Skin Deep, probably 14 years ago, we didn't think it would become the behemoth it is now. It's an amazing resource, and it has actually it's viewed about 9 million times a year. So we get amazing traffic to it. And the reason, one of the reasons that it gets so much traffic is because it came about at a time when nothing else was available like it. It came about at a time when people thought that if it was on the store shelves, it was safe. And as the years have gone by, more people have become educated about the fact that that's not true and far from it. And they're looking for resources to tell them what's safe, but also to give them some more information so they can make that decision about things themselves. And as we learn about policies and the lack thereof and the fact that in personal care, for example, the law hasn't been updated since the 1930s, you know, that makes our resource much more important because I hope people think, oh my God, what has changed since the 1930s? Everything but the cosmetics law. So that is definitely one of the main reasons that it has become such an amazing resource.
And I don't think they had face glitter back then, so, you know, we're not keeping up with the times there. Jen, as a scientist, data is one of your weapons of choice. How do you prioritize what to work on, and can you give us some examples of success?
Yeah, what we gather together with the scientists and our legal team and our policy and legislative folks when we do our priorities, and we look at what we think there is a high exposure to. So I hate to fall on risk assessments, but I mean, when you calculate risk, it is a calculation of both exposure and toxicity. So if you have something that you're exposed to every day, but it's not hazardous or not toxic, then it's not really a problem. If you have something that is very, very, very highly toxic, but you're not exposed to it, then that isn't a problem. And it's the overlap of those that the agencies and others begin to regulate and do risk assessment. Because remember, we allow things that cause cancer and things that blow up and explode and things that, you know, do bad things. We allow them, and sometimes we need them to do that, not cause cancer necessarily, but we do. Maybe a cancer treatment needs to interfere with cellular division, for example, or some things need to explode. That's what they need to do. So we regulate. So what we do is we look at where people are exposed at high levels. We look at what communities are exposed. So it could be that it's broad exposure to the population, like phthalates, for instance, or flame retardants, so plasticizer chemicals and flame retardants. Or it might be an exposure where it's not necessarily the broad population, but it's a community, an impacted community, and particularly if they have a lot of other chemicals or other hazardous exposures and other stresses that they have at the same time. TCE, trichloroethylene, is a good example of that, where you have, you know, some very polluted communities because of drinking water and vapor coming in and other things like that. So we look at exposures. We look at the chemical. Is it really, is it toxic? Is it hazardous? What kind of data do we have on it? What's the evidence? Obviously, as I said earlier, we want a lot of evidence, but we're not waiting for the epidemiology or something. Is there enough evidence to move on this from an agency or regulatory perspective? And then the last thing we look at is, do we think it's winnable? Are there communities? Is there a legal hook? What I have found, and I have done charts and Excel spreadsheets and looked at all the elements of success, is what I call it. And what I have found is where we're successful is where we have a legal hook. So God bless the law. Where we have science and data out there, a good study, a couple of good studies, whatever, and where the agency wants to do the right thing. So it doesn't have to be management level. It could be, you know, at the science or technical level, but you have people in the agency that want to do the right thing. And that sort of overlap is where we have success. Then we have also market campaigns too, and others like could talk a lot about that too. So it might not be from a regulatory perspective, those are the elements that we've seen are successful. An example is chlorpyrifos. So after 20 years, after 20 years and half a dozen lawsuits and a massive amount of campaigning and working with farm worker groups and environmental justice groups and we do and public education campaigns, we did have in 2015, the Obama administration did say this stuff is a no-go. It's too hazardous. It can't be used on food crops at all. They got stopped by the manufacturer. They tried again in November 2016, again issued the report saying no go, and that, of course, brought us into the Trump administration. So we'll keep on that, but, you know, getting the EPA to that point was huge. And it happened because there was lots of EPA people, staff, that saw that and wanted to do that. I think phthalates is another great example, plasticizers, that a lot more in market campaigns. So that has a lot more to do with public education and consumers. So when I talk to groups not as policy savvy and sophisticated as this one, I always remind them that your biggest power is your consumer power. Every time you spend a dollar, something has to replace that thing on the shelf, and so you can move markets. And so in the phthalates and the flame retardants has been very, very successful at the markets. State-level campaigns are also really successful, and it's that push that moves it towards a federal policy, hopefully.
On the phthalates, I'd like to give a shout out to Healthy Building Network, which really did a lot of the grunt work there in getting Home Depot and Lowe's to say that they would no longer accept flooring that contained the chemicals. So they deserve
also the electronics, the coatings on the electronics wires and stuff.
And then also Kaiser Permanente was another big push on the phthalates too. So, Eve, litigation. Good or bad? No. What is your opinion about the effectiveness of litigation and its ability to create lasting change in today's environment?
Well, good question, timely question. So, you know, to me, as a litigator, litigation is one piece of the puzzle. It does not. It usually does not stand alone as an effective approach, but I think that many of the other approaches are most effective when people understand that if the right thing doesn't happen, there will be litigation. So as a couple of examples, the two rules that I mentioned earlier that have been delayed, put on hold by the Trump administration, very quickly after they announced that they were putting these rules on hold, we brought lawsuits challenging them. We don't know yet whether those will be effective. As Jen has been talking about with the chlorpyrifos case, you know, for years, we've brought multiple lawsuits against EPA for failing to ban the food uses of chlorpyrifos because of the effects on workers and children, which are now abundantly well documented. But that litigation is part of, obviously, we need the science. The key thing with succeeding, hopefully we will succeed with the chlorpyrifos litigation, is that the science has been so clear that the Obama administration had to issue these human health risk assessments that found that the risk
risk succeeded concern because of exposure from drinking water and food for kids and for workers. Without that science, there's no way that we would win the litigation. And relatedly, I think that we really need the public to be aware of the concerns and to be demanding from agencies and from legislators that they don't want to be exposed to toxic chemicals and pesticides in their food, in their products, in their makeup. Because even if we win litigation, the laws that we base the litigation on could be undermined by congressional action unless there's broad public support for the legal victory. So, you know, I do think, you know, when agencies simply fail to act, and we've seen this time and time again, that we petition them to take actions that we think are legally required, they don't act in a timely way, we sue them for delay. The courts often set deadlines and require the agencies to take action. But for even when they take the right action, the health protective action, it's really critical that there be the broad public support for the action so that it's not undone at the legislative. So I think all of the work we do, I think, really just supports the other type of work.
Okay, this is a question for whoever wants to take it on. Why is it that it seems Europe is so much more advanced in regulating chemicals and keeping them out of the environment and products?
So I can start on that one because we see that a lot, especially in the personal care products realm. In Europe, they have banned or restricted more than 1,000 ingredients from personal care products, whereas the FDA here has banned just upwards of 10. So we talk about that a lot. And it's partly because in Europe, they use more of a precautionary principle. So if it seems like it won't be a healthy decision, if it won't be in the best interest of public health, if it could cause a problem, they will ban it or restrict it from products. In the U.S., it's quite the opposite. And again, here I'm talking about specifically the FDA and personal care, where the ingredients, the companies don't have to do pre-market testing or assessment. And if they do any assessment, they don't have to make that assessment public. So we have no idea of the potential impacts of those ingredients. So ingredients are used in personal care products, and we in turn become almost the petri dish or the guinea pig where the ingredient is tested. And then the FDA has limited authority, and this is by no fault of the FDA, but rather the authority they're given. They have limited authority for recall. But I could talk about that how many years since 1930s? As many of those years. But also in Europe, besides the precautionary principle, with REACH, they're able to move more quickly and regulate more quickly. Whereas here it can take many, many, many years. They're able to have turnover in a matter of months sometimes. But they have tremendous support from their administration and in turn, the European people support them as well. Here, if you don't have that support from the administration, the agencies cannot move quickly. If our science is always being stymied and put into loopholes where it's just regulatory inaction because you're asking for more and more evidence, which is what happens with all of our public health laws these days, it seems, then nothing moves. And so that's one of the reasons it's definitely moves more quickly in Europe.
Okay, I want to check my math. You said that we ban less than 1% of what Europe bans in personal care products.
Oh, roughly 1%.
Oh, roughly.
Yeah, roughly.
Yeah. Oh, well, that sounds a lot better then. Thank you for clarifying.
Some of the chemicals that have been banned are ones that we've talked about before, formaldehyde, a known human carcinogen that we've been working on for decades, is still allowed in personal care products. Ingredients that are linked to hormone disruption through epidemiological studies are still in personal care products. And certainly the response is going to be, how much personal care products do you even use? Is it a problem? But the deodorant we put on this morning was a personal care product. We use, you know, upwards of 10
on average, if you average women and men, personal care products each day. And the whole thing about low doses, as we all know, low doses matter. And all of these things matter. And we haven't been able to look into the synergistic effects of chemicals and on and on and on. We need more science. We need more funding for this sort of science. And then we need the agencies to be able to make laws that utilize the science and protect us from chemical harm.
And just to add to that on the personal care products and the low doses, many of them are used in salons, like formaldehyde is a part of like hair straighteners and other products that are used in salons where workers are exposed day in and day out for, you know, hours at a time. So it's not just like a person that might use them occasionally.
I actually think California is working on some legislation in that regard for the workers in those salons. So that kind of leads right into this next question. What two things would you like to see, if you could do anything, that you think would enhance the public's protection from chemical exposure? And I ask that of each of you. Eve, do you want to start?
Sure. Do you want me to give just two right
now?
Oh, no. So, if you, yeah, I'll just give two. You know, in this one, I'm just going to try to forget about the Trump administration right now and not, you know, just broadly speaking. I mean, one thing that I think has been is a huge problem is the lack of information. And some of that relates to the abuse of confidential business information where chemical manufacturers can claim that something is, you know, that it's a trade secret and somehow revealing the name of their chemical or some of the effects of their chemicals would interfere with their economic profit. Of course, that could be the case if we knew what the hazards were from their chemicals. But often they're allowed by EPA and other agencies to claim that confidential business information, just the name of the chemical. In some instances, the location of where chemicals are manufactured are claimed as CBI, so people don't know. You know, yes, there's a facility down the street, but you might not know what's being manufactured there. In a couple instances, we found that, you know, well-known chemical manufacturers like Chemtura, which is the largest manufacturer of flame retardants, they routinely submit reports to EPA regarding the production volume of their chemicals, and they claim that their name is confidential, as if nobody knows that Chemtura manufactures flame retardant. So anyway, those, I think the lack of information about the names of chemicals, where they're manufactured, production volumes, and key data points involving those chemicals is a huge obstacle to people being able to protect themselves. So that's one. And the other is, you know, I think that we're all aware of the fact that one of the problems with, and actually the videos you were showing earlier about the six classes of chemicals highlights this point that, you know, that many chemicals, when science has shown that a particular chemical poses risks, that the way that the industry has responded is by creating a similar but similarly toxic chemical, but that, you know, is not regulated or that's not so well known. So BPA becomes BPS. Brominated flame retardants are replaced with chlorinated flame retardants, which are replaced with phosphate-based flame retardants, and the risks are very similar and concerning. So I think that we really need to hopefully develop better approaches for regulating chemicals by toxic class rather than regulating phthalates one by one by one. We should be regulating the entire class of phthalates. We should be regulating all brominated flame retardants rather than just, you know, a particular brominated flame retardant. So that we can move away from this situation where we're substituting one toxic chemical with another toxic chemical and where the science and the regulatory systems can't keep up with these, you know, subtle changes that the industry is making.
Yeah, I think Eve and I are thinking with one mind. I have I have a list as long as my arm, but my top two would be similar to yours. The first one for me is also regulatory, and it would be to end or stop the loopholes, like I mentioned before, that just foster this inaction. The loopholes that anytime there is a policy that's health protective, they get stuck in this quagmire where nothing can happen because the industry is asking for more studies or asking for legal action, and so no action happens. And unfortunately, with the Regulatory Accountability Act that is coming up, that may just bolster that. And that's a huge threat to any rulemaking coming down the pike that would be health protective. I'm not sure if you all are familiar with the RAA, but if you're not, you should become familiar with it, and it's quite scary. You know, this administration may end, but if the RAA is put into place, that will continue on for decades. My other wish on my wish list, again, is similar to Eve's. Eve mentioned CBI, and I would want greater transparency in general. There's a lot that people are able to do. As Jen mentioned, the power of a dollar, there's a lot that they can do once they know what's going on. And we've seen that in personal care. We've seen that in furniture with flame returns. If they know, regrettable substitution is an issue as well. But the buy-in power that we have is amazing. Unfortunately, while you may avoid triclosan in your hand soap, you may not realize it's in your cutting board and in your socks and in your clothing and everywhere else because it doesn't have to be labeled. So more transparency so that where we don't have policies that are able to stop those chemicals from getting into consumer products, we can not purchase them and not bring them into our homes. So those would be the top two on my list.
Right. Thank you.
I get to be really short because I go last. Okay, so I had labeling, public awareness, and transparency first, so checking that off. I had regulations as a backstop to protect all humans, all Americans, I said, because even though for all those who can't afford to shop their way out of the problem. So it's not like we can all go and buy our, what was it, the organic vegan hokey pokey muffin. So
with no sugar.
Yeah.
Sugar free.
But so now I'm down to campaign finance reform. I'll just leave it at that.
Yes, please. We could be here for days if we wanted to enter that. Yes. So, Jen, I'll let you start for this one. This is the last question I have, and then we'll open it up for questions from the audience. None of you are new to this fight. So do you think that we're actually making some real progress in the last, you know, decades, or as more chemicals keep entering the marketplace, are we just falling behind?
So I am actually positive about this question. I think that our public education and public awareness and all the media, I know that Twitter's gotten a little bad name lately, but the ability to share information in real time is an activist dream. I mean, it is fantastic. I mean, activists used to not be able to make long-distance calls. Nobody had the budget, right? Now we can work all over the world in seconds. So I do actually think that we do have the power to make this. And I want to give an example and then end on one note. I want to give an example of the Flint lead water. I want to say that was not a science issue, right? Not a science issue. But litigation and working with community groups on the ground who are impacted groups and who are knowledgeable and had very, very sophisticated technical knowledge of what was happening, having insiders in the local governments who wanted to do the right thing, and having journalists. And I don't think we can sit in the museum and not mention the role of journalists in every single point that we've brought up, because there is absolutely no way we could do our work without brave journalists and investigative journalists. And so I want to sort of bring them into my final point and say that, yes, I do think that as long as we have those elements, we can continue to do this work and succeed. And I also just want to say that the last time I was in this room was not long ago, unfortunately. It was less than a few months ago, and I stood here, and I was crying, and everybody in the room was crying, and we were having a memorial to Andy Schneider. who was one of the great, one of the great investigative journalists on toxics. He died. We lost him. But we do, that it is a call to journalists to get out the word and to be brave and bold and to make sure, because what agency staff are going up against and what journalists are going up against is a lot of money and a lot of power. And so we do all need to support each other.
For me, I echo Jen's point, and public education through the work that we're all doing, the work of the journalists, has been a positive over the last decade for me. So I definitely see that. I also think that we have, in our various organizations, we've been able to stop even worse laws from being passed and through litigation. And so we've been able to stop worse laws. So that has been good as well. It could be worse. And right now we're standing holding firm, hoping that it won't get worse. But while doing that, pushing for greater policy and continuing to educate the public and have them feel empowered, to make decisions and better decisions, we think of that as a positive.
Yeah. So I hate to end on a sort of slightly more negative note, but I think we have made progress in protecting people from exposure to chemicals and pesticides, but I think that the progress has been really uneven and certainly hasn't, you know, been spread evenly across communities of color and low-income communities. And, you know, thinking about Flint and lead, I think statistically we know that over the last few decades that blood lead levels of kids in this country have definitely declined dramatically, but there's still, over 500,000 kids with elevated blood lead levels, and they're disproportionately kids from communities of color and low-income communities, and that's just unacceptable. And, you know, when we think about some of the chemicals in consumer products, a lot of those, food, processed food has much higher levels of chemicals, and who's eating more processed food or packaged food where the phthalates are leaching from the plastic into the cheese or the meat, and products that are bought at dollar stores are much more likely to include many of these chemicals imported from China, where there's fewer restrictions. So I think I think the positive of this is that we know, I think we know much more about the health harms of these chemicals, and they're definitely, through market campaigns and litigation and science, we are definitely making headway, but we need to do a much better job at making sure that that all people are getting the same level of protection.
Okay, great. Anybody?
Hi. In some of my public health classes at JW, I've learned about the presence of small chemicals in the water supply, so things like byproducts from pharmaceuticals and hormones, endocrine disruptors. And a lot of our focus has been on addressing the upstream factors for a lot of environmental concerns. So I'm just wondering what you all would recommend and how we approach this problem.
From a consumer perspective, filter your water. That's just a shout out there. EWG has been working on tap water quality for decades, and there are hundreds of chemicals in our tap water, chemicals that are industrial, agricultural, related to manure and runoff, and just chemicals that you don't want to think about in your drinking water. I think the last time a new chemical was added to the regulatory scheme was in 1996. Arsenic was updated later than that, but it was already on that list. So again, there we just haven't had any action. And just like chlorpyrifos, we have science showing harm, but not moving towards regulatory action. But then there are newer chemicals that we haven't been thinking about, like medication, and the more you test for, the more you will find. But we are using all of these chemicals daily, and when you wash it off or flush it down the toilet, it gets into our drinking water. And for how our approach to it, to answer your question, is education. Like, people, if you don't know about a problem, you're not taking the steps to solve that problem as a person. But once you're solving that problem by buying a filter, if you need one, then we have to rally as a community. And our voices have to be heard by policymakers. Whether it's at the federal level or at the state level, you need to have policymakers hear that this is something that's really important to you. Because when it comes around to election season, you bet they're going to be listening. So we need to make our voices heard and say things like water quality, drinking water quality is an issue. I'm concerned about it. Things like Flint shouldn't be happening, but that made the big scale. But there are other communities in East LA, for example. There are other communities throughout the U.S. that have too many contaminants in their drinking water, and we're not doing enough to protect the source waters. So the industry continues to pollute, and we continue to pay for it rather than the opposite, which is the polluter should be paying, but that's not happening right now.
Thank you. At the regulatory level, your examples are complicated. They're endocrine disruptors, disinfection byproducts you mentioned in pharmaceuticals, right? Which are a lot of endocrine disruptors or like mood stabilizers. And they're really difficult questions because nobody wants to say, look, you guys need to stop taking your birth control. Sorry. Actually, I always joke it's the Prozac in the water that makes us feel better about all these problems. So, we also recommend drinking water filters. ANSI Standard 53 is the one you want to look at. Things like Brita's and stuff meet it, but that only works in your tap, so it doesn't work for all the intersex fish that are out there and everything else. One thing that the Office of Water is doing in EPA is they're trying to look at starting to do the groups of chemicals in terms of the filtration systems or the treatment systems, and that way when communities and community water systems invest in their water treatment programs, they'll be investing in something that will take care of a whole bunch of different toxicants or pollutants at once and not one by one. So starting to group them because, as you said, Nika, the EPA Office of Water hasn't set a new MCL or a maximum contaminant limit for a drinking water standard in 25 years. They only regulate like something like under 100, and we have like 50,000 we know are in frack chemicals, like right off the bat.
So, for lead.
Well, lead has a standard.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But it's not a binding MCL.
But everything, single thing you name, doesn't it? Yeah. Then it's not, that's right. So, what the EPA Office of Water is doing is starting to look at groups now, and I do actually think that's really brilliant.
Thanks. A quick plug for the Building Clean site. We have information for home water filtration systems on there, including lists of those that are made in the United States, and it explains, you know, how to find what chemicals, et cetera, et cetera. So if you need some information on that and you're worried about what's going on at home, your own home, check out buildingclean.org. We have time for one more question. Is there another question? Yes.
Hello, I'm Zachary Quinn with Public Citizen. And my question kind of relates to the other question in that how do we push our lawmakers and the agencies that oversee infrastructure to put in systems that deal with these contaminants, not just health-related ones from personal products, et cetera, but like you mentioned, fracking, oil and gas industry in general, putting thousands upon thousands of contaminants in our water that our systems simply can't handle or cannot even detect.
Yeah, I think the answer is similar in terms of making your elected official hear that that's a big concern for you. Infrastructure and source water protection programs and all of these issues that can affect our water quality are huge, and they require funding. And so we need to support the utilities because they need more funding too, but also support projects that would improve the infrastructure.
Just one quick thought I have. I mean, I know one thing that at the state legislative level, one thing that people sometimes do is they offer state legislators the option of having biomonitoring so that they can see, well, what are all the chemicals that are in their body? And there's nothing that's more sort of inspiring to a legislator than to find out what's in his or her body, what are all the different chemicals. And I wonder about, doing a sort of as maybe a similar screen to offer to legislators of their water, like, just a deep, very comprehensive screen to see what chemicals are coming out of their tap and whether that might help motivate them.
And Eve, can I circle around to your earlier point, though, and saying the answer is not buying bottled water. So, I mean, it's, what I said, I know, yeah, we all know it. I mean, we have to protect the people that can't go pay, $20 for their quart of water. Yeah. We need to do it at the system level.
Absolutely.
And, in fact, a lot of the bottled water actually isn't filtered, so you're not gaining any health-wise. But I do like that, and we should add that to our policy list to monitor everybody up on the hill and let them see. Well, I thank you very much for sharing with us and answering these questions. I thought it was really a great panel to hear some specifics on chemicals. But I will say, just in case you guys missed it, one takeaway is if you're feeling kind of nervous and anxious, just drink more water, okay? So with that, thank you very much. Okay, I know time is getting late, but so this is the good news, bad news, is Congressman Raskin is still tied up in committee because they're doing votes there. So he is not going to make it, is my guess. They left it open, but I'm going to say it's about a 1% chance. So Jackie will be our last speaker. So I'm going to bring her up here shortly. Jackie Patterson is the director of the NAACP Environmental and Climate Justice Program. Since 2007, Patterson has worked as a coordinator and co-founder of Women of Color United. She's also worked as a researcher, program manager, coordinator, advocate, and activist on women's rights, violence against women, HIV and AIDS, racial justice, economic justice, emergency response, and environmental and climate justice. She currently serves on the Steering Committee for Interfaith Moral Action on Climate, the Advisory Board for Center for Earth Ethics, as well as the boards of directors for the Institute of the Black World, Center for Story-Based Strategy, Grid Alternatives, and the U.S. Climate Action Network. She's all around expertise here, so she's perfect to send us off with her wisdom. Jackie, please come up.
Great. So I'll be quick for sure. So I was asked to speak about the impacts of the cuts that the proposed cuts to the EPA, particularly on communities of color. And I wanted to start out with kind of the note, the cover note that was sent by 45 to Congress. It opens up the budget, America First, a budget blueprint to make America great again, because it's important to kind of ground us in the words and the ethos that really has resulted in the various cuts that we're seeing happening. So our aim is to meet the simple but crucial demand of our citizens, a government that puts the needs of its own people first. When we do that, we will set free the dreams of every American, and we will begin a new chapter of American greatness. A budget that puts America first must make the safety of our people within its number one priority, because without safety, there can be no prosperity. The core of my first budget blueprint is the rebuilding of our nation's military without adding to our federal deficit. There is a $54 billion increase in defense spending in 2018 that is offset by targeted reductions elsewhere. And so the elsewhere is the topic of my remarks. So as we all know, the budget has targeted the EPA, which has been called by 45 a disgrace, in order to fund an increase in the military's $600 billion budget while cutting the agency's funding by 31%. That's $2.6 billion. and eliminating a workforce of 3,200 staff members. And so this is in a context of an agency that's already historically been grossly under-resourced. So really speaking truth about the reality of the EPA in context in terms of history. In September of 2016, the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights actually released a report that found the EPA had a history of being unable to meet its regulatory deadlines and experiences extreme delays in responding to the Title VI complaints in the area of environmental justice. And we know that this is because it has historically been not only not been properly resourced to do this work, but has also been up against a hostile environment often in terms of what it's being approved to do. So over the past 20 years, they've rejected 9 out of 10 complaints from communities plagued by pollution and has yet to find a business in breach of the Civil Rights Act's Title VI provisions against discrimination on environmental grounds. But again, EPA has been hamstrung by both the gross lack of funds necessary to do the monitoring and enforcement, and then it also has a very restrictive definition of the circumstances under which enforcement can happen, with this whole notion of the standard of intent. So it would be hard to, you know, if I close my eyes and drove down my car down Constitution Avenue during rush hour amidst other motorists and people crossing the street, I could say that I wasn't aiming for anyone and I didn't intend to mow down anyone. They just happened to be in the way when I was driving down the street with my eyes closed. And so that wouldn't be a defense in the court of law against vehicular homicide. And it shouldn't be the standard that EPA is forced to uphold when it comes to the disproportionate impact of pollution on communities of color and low-income communities. So we see the result of these difficult standards, of this lack of resources that EPA is suffering under. We see a place like Uniontown, Alabama, which is a predominantly African-American community in Alabama, and where EPA ended up having to allow coal ash to be dumped in the landfill in the town in order to appease economic interest, and really for years has failed to really deal with the fact that it's been polluting the community in horrific ways. We all know the story of Flint, Michigan, and we all know the various oversights and neglect and so forth that has resulted in that situation building to the to where they are today. Less known is the situation in East Chicago, Indiana, where there's this public housing project where it was built, the West Calumet Housing Project, which was built on contaminated land on a Superfund site. And over the years, EPA has tried to remediate it, but without success. And so a recent soil sample found that, so the acceptable amount of lead in the soil is 400 parts per million, and a recent soil sample found 91,000 parts per million of lead in the soil. And these are the soil that kids are running and playing in and tracking into their homes. And one home, when they tested the dust in the home, they found 32,000 parts per million of lead in the home of one of the families there. And this is, again, a situation that we don't even hear about, but a situation where now all these families are having to be moved out of the only home that they've known for in some cases for generations, because the level of toxicity is so intense and because they haven't been able to remediate it in spite of attempts to do so. So these are the kind of communities, and these are the kind of existence that the folks are having even under the existing resources of EPA, not to mention pulling back by 31%. We have places like Mossville in Louisiana, where one company on top of another company was allowed to build there and pollute these communities to the extent where now it's a cancer cluster and it's just unlivable. And so they're actually proposing another place to be built there on top of all these other chemical plants that are there. So basically they're giving a buyout option to this community. So again, this is yet another community where it's being forced to move from the only place that they've ever called home, and they're being kind of torn asunder because for example, in the East Chicago situation, it's all Section 8 housing. And in the whole of Indiana, there aren't enough Section 8 housing voucher spots for those families that have to be moved. So they're having to move to whole other states. Again, having to move away from the only people that you've ever grown up with, the only home that you've ever known, and then potentially to a whole other state. And one of the places they're moving to is actually Chicago, in this place called All Gale Gardens in Chicago. And the reason why there's so many openings there is because it's such a dangerous place, and it has its own history of pollution as well as being a pretty gang
gang-ridden place. It's a place where you, as a young man, you have to affiliate with a gang. You have to claim a gang allegiance in order to just be there. It's a prerequisite for living there, or you will be, your life is in jeopardy. And so these are, so they're moving from one toxic situation into another toxic situation, but really being given no choice because of these contexts. And then I was recently in Alaska where in the Northwest Arctic Borough, they have the Red Dog Mines that has been fined 600 times over the years for contaminating the waterways there. So again, this is under the existing EPA where at least they were able to monitor and enforce and apply these fines. But the fact that that can even exist, that place can still operate after being in violation at least 600 times, those are the 600 times that they were caught. And so who knows how many times they actually were in violation. So these are the contexts that we're already in. And yet we're talking about 31% rollbacks. And so this years of combination of poor urban planning and sporadic regulation has resulted in communities in populations like African American children who are 3 to 5 times more likely to enter into the hospital from an asthma attack, 2 to 3 times more likely to die of asthma attack, and because of living in these toxic zones with cumulative impacts of all these toxins in their communities. Yet within these really constrained circumstances, the EPA has been able to enact programs that have helped marginalized communities and other communities. Since 1994, the EPA program has delivered $24 million to 1,400 community groups who really rely on the EPA for its funding. They have produced tools like the EJ Screen, the mapping tool that has enabled people to be able to advocate and educate their own communities about what's going on. Whenever I go to California, someone always talks about the value that CalScreen has had for their community as an example. And one particular community in Los Angeles talks about how it enabled them to educate their communities about the synthetic rubber and DDT contamination that they had in their community. And related to this, I always want to start a petition to use the word relatedly. I think relatedly should be a word. But related to this, one of the major initiatives in the proposed budget is to take an axe to brownfield programs and Superfund cleanups and job brownfield job training programs. And the Green Door Initiative in Detroit is a program that benefited from the Green Jobs Training Program, where they have trained over 200 individuals, largely African-American males, where in a place like Detroit where unemployment is in the double digits and where a lot of the associated problems come with that, they've been able to really alleviate that by really cleaning up the toxins in their community as well as providing a employment opportunity, which is co-benefits in that program. A place like Spartansburg, South Carolina, where they also had this legacy of inadequate zoning laws and toxins in the community and a largely African-American community, where with a $20,000 grant from EPA, they've managed to leverage that into over $200 million in grants that they've gotten over the years. And now they have a program where they have demolished homes and homes that were toxic homes and been able to build homes where people are actually homeowners. They've been able to do a STEM program to train kids. They have a whole program where they've been able to hold polluters accountable and get them to invest back into the communities. So they've addressed a dump site, a former fertilizer plant, 6 brownfield and Superfund sites in that community, all from that $20,000 grant that from EPA that got them started on that. In the Inuit hub town of Kotzebue in Alaska, there was a $34 million seawall that was built there because, as we know, they're very threatened by sea level rise there. And EPA over the years has spent $78 million in Alaska and to address climate change issues in the indigenous communities there. And again, that in the Alaskan village assistance is being targeted for cuts by this administration. So there's just so many examples. I could go on and on, but I do want us to be able to go in a reasonable amount of time. So I'm just skipping through a lot of the things. In terms of the cuts as well, we have so those are some of the examples of the things that EPA has done that's been positive even within their constrained situations. But yet now when we talk about the cuts that are happening, they're largely, you know, really affirming this kind of polluter-friendly circumstance with not only cabinet appointees like the transition team leader who was a known climate denier. We have an administrator who has sued the EPA 13 times, as we know, and has deep ties to the oil and gas industry. And so it's really become these rollbacks are really a death sentence for these communities that we've talked about, and so many more who are standing in harm's way, and who are really standing to die, death of a thousand cuts, literally and figuratively. Cheryl Johnson is the executive director of People for Community Recovery, which is a 37-year-old nonprofit in Allgill Gardens in Chicago. And she I was born in Chicago, and I spent the last few days there at a meeting. And over the weekend, there were 56 shootings, 11 of whom were fatal shootings, and one was a 10-year-old boy. So these are the kind of contexts that people are residing in. Cheryl said in response to these proposed cuts, it's almost like I might as well just kill myself because I will have no protection. I won't have the resources to be able to go and educate my community or educate even just my family about the environmental hazards in our community. This is someone who's been doing this work for 37 years. So when we talk about the rollback of the methane emissions and the impacts that it's going to have in terms of the fact that the oil and gas industry, a lot of the operations happen in communities of color and low-income communities, when we talk about the signing of the executive order to expedite the approval of the Dakota Access Pipeline and the impacts that we're already seeing in communities there, we're talking about a 23% cut in the Office of Enforcement, which is the office that is supposed to be punishing polluters, and these polluters are largely polluting in communities of color and low-income communities, eliminating two programs designed to limit children's exposure to lead-based paint, which, of course, in terms of the data that we see from the various monitoring and surveillance, that kids of color are more likely to be exposed to lead-based paint than African-American and Latino-American kids. We're talking about striking down a rule intended to prevent coal mining debris from polluting streams. I was in near Wilmington, South North Carolina, where there was a fishing pier built on a coal ash pond, and it was built by Duke Energy, the one that was polluting the coal ash pond. And so people were fishing out of it. There were fishing advisories, you know, posted there. I mean, I was just bemused. I felt like I didn't understand what was going on, because it just didn't seem like it was possible to really build a fishing pier on a coal ash pond intentionally. It's not like the fishing pier was there and then they, you know. Anyway, so there's that. And then we have the situation where there's now a planned review of the Clean Water Act, with this notion of, again, not wanting to be too punitive around businesses and not wanting to hold back progress of businesses. Then we have the cutting of the low-income heating and energy assistance program, LIHEAP, where, again, African-Americans are 13% of the population, but 23 to 25% of the people who are dependent on LIHEAP. We just put out a report called Lights Out in the Cold, Reforming Utility Shutoff Policies as if Human Rights Matter. And it really called up the fact that there are people all over the country and who have actually died after having their electricity cut off, either because they've used candles to light their home, and in using that candles, the candles end up burning down the home. There's people who have used generators to run their appliances, but they kept the generators inside, so the carbon monoxide has built up and killed whole families. There are families who have their oil shut off or their gas shut off for their heating, and then they use space heaters, and we all know the space heaters are notoriously dangerous, and so whole families have perished from using. The catalyst for us to really do this report, we had already gotten the data from a George Washington University law student, but then we decided to do the report when in Baltimore, where our headquarters is, a family of nine became a family of three after a space heater burned down their home over the holidays in this cold snap over the recent holidays. So we have, you know, these kind of things happening and that really call to the fact that people are literally paying the price of poverty with death in a place where, you know, the sun is in abundance and we shouldn't have to have the level of energy poverty that many communities suffer under. So I'm going to kind of not give you the 30 other examples of cuts and just wrap up with just the fact that the communities are rising up. Also, I was going to give you a little bit of a sense of some of the intersectional cuts that are happening in other departments that are intersectional and really exacerbate the impacts of the cuts of the EPA. But again, I will wrap up by just saying the things that people are doing to address this is increased vigilance. Now communities are developing more community science programs so that we're monitoring our own air, water, and and soil quality, and working with universities and community campus partnerships so we have that data that's necessary for us to be able to call for action. For example, in Chicago, again, there's a partnership with the Harvard School of Public Health that attributed 40 deaths and 1,000 hospitalizations to the Fisk and Crawford coal plants. And that was really the ammunition they needed to go to the city council, go to the community and say, because of this data, we feel we need to pass a clean air ordinance to protect our communities from the impact of the coal burning in our communities. And that's what enabled them to be able to then have Rahm Emanuel give an ultimatum to the Midwest Generation and say you either need to clean them up or turn them off. And so they were successful in getting those two coal plants shut down as a result. They were able to negotiate a just transition for the workers, and now they have a whole redevelopment project for what's now brownfield, to make that into green space and to make that into all these other multi-use facilities. So that's an example of a victory from vigilance, from partnership, and from advocacy based on evidence-based data. We also are really engaging in resistance. Earlier we were talking about litigation, so now we're seeing, because of the policies not necessarily being there to protect communities, we're having to go to the courts and a little bit more than we had to before, as well as looking at if federal policy isn't going to be there, what kind of local ordinances, like the Chicago situation, how can we look at local ordinances, state-level policies, and so forth. And then finally, in terms of resilience, we're building the alternative. So if we're not going to be able to get a just transition from utility companies, we're starting to develop microgrids, community solar gardens, really developing, working more on energy efficiency at the local level. And we're doing this in a way that not only pushes a transition away from polluting practices and policies, I mean, yeah, polluting, yeah, both actually, and to actually seeing where we are also building wealth in communities and building autonomy, because a lot of the same utilities that are taking in our revenue, African Americans, for example, spend $40 billion on energy every year, only have 1.1% of the energy jobs and have less than 0.1% of the revenue from the energy sector. And those profits are being used to pay into ALEC, which then goes and not only pushes back against the policies that we need to protect our air, but also pushes back against voting rights and so forth. So we have this cycle of disenfranchisement and the impacts on communities. So we're really pushing forward with an alternative that really builds local power, literally and figuratively. So I will end on that note. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Jackie. As I told you, very well-rounded and knowledgeable on many aspects of this. So with that, we're going to wrap it up. I'm sorry that the congressman didn't make it, but I do think that today I learned at least a lot about the challenges that are out there, but also some, areas of hope, not only in where we have one and the tactics that we've used and the rise of community groups, standing up for themselves. And I think, creating their own power in the literal sense is probably the most fantastic thing you can see, where they're like, okay, you know what? We don't want to pay you any money. We're just going to make our own. So, I mean, that's great. The other thing I think is, because of so many different groups that are in this room, that's a message of hope too, because there's so many ways that we can all join together to fight this. So with that being said, I want to really quickly thank the museum staff for helping us out here. I want to thank our staff, Caitlin Seppi, who's the Building Clean Program Manager, and Griffin Bird, and is Rebecca in here? Oh, right there, she's now. Rebecca, who are legislative Tiramu? Tamaru, sorry about that, who are legislative interns. We will be sending out an electronic evaluation, and it will include where you can sign up to get updates from Building Clean on other events and activities. So I encourage you to add your email to that list. And if you can just give me one more round of applause for all of our wonderful speakers. Go out into this hot, hot day.